The sheer devastation and loss of life that occurred in the wake of the school shootings at Marjory Stoneman Douglas in Parkland have been weighing on the minds of everyone in the United States, but especially among healthcare providers. The number of mass shootings in the U.S. has significantly increased since the federal assault weapons ban expired in 2004. According to 2015 data from the CDC, more than 36,000 people died of gunshot wounds. Yet the public has been largely shielded from viewing the destructive nature of these bullets and how they rip organs apart and injure precious nerves, blood vessels, and tissue. The firearm that we'll discuss today is the AR-15 and was the recent topic of a very powerful essay in The Atlantic by Dr. Heather Scherer, a radiologist on call the day of the Parkland shootings. In her article, she vividly describes the horrific and destructive CT findings of the bullets from the AR-15 and contrasts these with the wounds of bullets from a 9mm handgun. Here to discuss the ballistics as well as the care of patients after such gunshot wounds is Dr. Heather Scherer, a board-certified diagnostic radiologist, Dr. Amy Goldberg, Chair and Professor, Department of Surgery, Surgeon-in-Chief at Temple University Health System, as well as Dr. Joseph Sacrin, Director of Emergency General Surgery and Assistant Professor of Surgery at Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions. Welcome, doctors, and thank you again for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Yep, thanks for having us.
Quite an honor to have everyone together and to discuss this. Dr. Scherer, I want to begin with you and really kind of go into the differences seen on imaging studies between low and high velocity gunshot wounds and how the velocity of these bullets fired from the AR-15 compares with, say, a standard 9mm handgun.
So I'm a diagnostic radiologist, and I've spent my career in level one trauma centers. I've been in clinical practice for 14 years. So I've seen many, many handgun injuries over the years. And as a radiologist, I have a unique perspective in that most of these patients, if they're stable enough not to require emergent surgery, they're scanned from head to toe. So I have kind of a bird's eye view of what these injuries looked at. So I found myself in a position where I've seen two recent mass shootings, which is a unique position to be in. One of them was at the airport, at Fort Lauderdale Airport, in which the gunman used a 9mm handgun with a low velocity bullet. And the second mass murder that I was involved in was in the care of patients from Parkland, in which the shooter used an AR-15. So very different injuries and very different outcomes for the patients. Mm-hmm. With the handgun injuries, this is the type of injury that we're used to seeing in day-to-day practice. The bullet leaves a linear track through the body, and we can see that track on imaging. For example, in a solid organ, if the bullet travels through, let's say, the liver, for example, we can generally see the linear track of the bullet from entry wound to exit wound, and there'll be some bleeding. But it's just the injury is the permanent cavity that the bullet leaves, and it's traceable through the liver. That's in stark contrast to the injuries that we see with the AR-15. This is something that I read about, but in 14 years of practice had never seen. I'd seen once before in a SWAT injury and only recalled it after seeing the recent injuries from the Parkland shooting. The injuries vary. These are high velocity bullets.
So this obviously took you by surprise. All of a sudden you got an image, a scan of some devastating wound here, and certainly it sparked memory, I can imagine.
Yeah, in the airport injury, I didn't even realize that anything was going on until I read the third case, because it's what I see in day-to-day. With the AR-15 injuries, it causes a huge swath of tissue damage from something that's called temporary cavitation.
Can you explain a little bit more what cavitation means to the audience?
It's almost like a radial stretch injury. You have a permanent cavity that where the linear track of the bullet passes, but there's a wave of energy that as the kinetic energy is imparted to the patient, which causes the elastic tissue to move away from the bullet and then return back. And that whole swath of tissue is damaged.
It's
a 4 to 6 inch area that's damaged. It's completely different. With a low velocity gunshot wound, it just depends what it hits. If you hit an artery directly, you know, that's lethal. If you hit the heart directly, it's lethal. But here, you just have to be in proximity to something like a vessel to have catastrophic bleeding.
Now, these bullets are smaller. These are very small, nimble bullets. Isn't that correct? And they travel faster, obviously. Their muzzle velocity is much greater.
It's a function of the velocity. The low velocity injuries, like the handguns, are like 1,200 feet per second, more or less.
Right.
And these are 3,200 feet per second. So these really fast, small bullets result totally different pattern of injury. The physics is different in terms of the cavitation phenomenon we talked about.
Right.
And what in the patient is completely different. You know, like I said, in a solid organ, you see a large area of tissue destruction. Mm-hmm. If you were anywhere near the porta hepatis or the, you know, the vascular pedicle of the spleen, that patient would never make it to us. You know, in bone, too, in a long bone injury, the bone is absent. It's like sawdust. You know, there's a whole six-inch segment of bone that's just gone when you shoot it. And that's, there are images from military surgeons that were posted in the New York Times that are just, was very, illustrate that point perfectly.
Right. So I'm going to turn to you, Dr. Goldberg, and get your take on these. Obviously, you're on the front lines. You're in the operating room. You're in the ICU. You resuscitate these patients. Can you tell me what you're seeing physically in these wounds, exit and entry, and how you're managing them and from a damage control standpoint?
Yeah, I've been a trauma surgeon in North Philadelphia, Temple Hospital, for about 25 years now. I can't say that I am a ballistics expert, but unfortunately, I am an expert on what bullets can do to bodies. And, you know, you can take what Heather has said and apply that to what it looks like when you make that incision and you're now peering at the liver that has become morselized by the high energy of these assault rifles. Mm-hmm. So the wounds are so large. They are large cavitary wounds, whether it's the liver or the spleen. Mm-hmm. It can be aorta and the cava, and you are doing your best, you know, first of all, to stop the bleeding, whether that's packing, whether that's clamping. You know, you are just feverishly trying to stop the patient from exsanguinating and dying on the OR table immediately.
Right. So in terms of damage control techniques and what certainly came out of the battlefield, these wounds become problematic from these types of projectiles. I mean, just to really resuscitate the patient to get them to the ICU, because they often will die on you. Isn't that correct? I mean, because with a standard handgun injury, I mean, you at least have some time. But with the sheer destruction internally, I think I'd imagine you just don't have that time.
Yeah, I mean, if you are lucky enough to, you know, get the patient up to the operating room, then at least you have a chance to be able to stop the patients from bleeding. You know, many of the patients that we've seen in these mass casualty incidences have died at the scene and haven't made it to the hospitals. If you're lucky enough to get the patient to the hospital, you know, really what your first job is trying to, at the same time as stopping the bleeding, resuscitating the patient, you know, with blood and blood products and doing whatever you can from packing and clamping.
Right. Dr. Sacrin, I would like to get your take on this and add to Dr. Goldberg and Dr. Scher's thoughts. And how are you managing patients at Hopkins that come in these types of situations? I would imagine you've seen, obviously, some assault weapons injuries, as well as, obviously, handguns more commonly. Is there anything in your management that you'd like to discuss and bring out?
Thank you, Dr. Glatter, for having us. And sure. I think this is a very relevant and a timely discussion. I think, as you heard Dr. Goldberg mention, a lot of these patients that we get, we have a couple priorities when we're approaching this from a damage control perspective. And really the number one priority is to control hemorrhage. And, you know, unfortunately in cities like Philadelphia and Baltimore, we're seeing this on a daily basis where, you know, clearly there are victims that are being brought in a spectrum of, critical illness, those that, mm-hmm. you know, need to be rushed to the operating room for life saving hemorrhage control, and those that sometimes are admitted and subsequently discharged. Right. And I will tell you that while a lot of these mass shootings that we see really get the majority of the media attention, one of the important aspects that we have to recognize is that firearm deaths are happening on a daily basis. And these are affecting Americans and communities all across this country. And I think sometimes, you know, we forget about those individuals that are suffering these violent tragedies.
Right. And I think that's an important point you bring up. Statistics indicate 80 or 90 people a day are dying of gunshot wounds. And yet, certainly they don't make the papers. It's these mass shootings. And I think drawing attention to this epidemic is something that's just imperative.
I could not agree with you more. You know, patients are being shot and dying on the corners of our communities and our cities every day and every night in Philadelphia, in Baltimore, in Chicago, in Detroit. I mean, it is all so very tragic. And yeah, as Joe said, the attention does get paid to the mass casualties and these mass shootings, which are absolutely terrible. but we should never lose sight of what's continuing on in our cities.
Right. What kind of interventions, Dr. Goldberg, are you doing in your, say, emergency department ICUs that, for young victims of gun violence in their teens? Is there any way to get to these children, to the families, to really to have an impact?
Well, we really believe that education is the first step towards prevention. You know, right now, if you ask students what do they know about gun violence, really what they know about gun violence is what they might see on TV or on a video or, you know, listening to some hip hop. But we really want to educate them on what bullets and what guns can do to parents. And we have a program called the Cradle to Grave Program. We've been running the program for about 12 years now, where we really look to educate students in junior high school and high school about really what guns can do.
I'm a radiologist, so we like to categorize things. And so, you know, I don't see gun violence as one disease. You know, mass murders, as you've mentioned, is one small portion of it.
Right.
And you know, the toll is more than just the death toll. It's the toll it takes on society, as we're grieving here in Fort Lauderdale. But, you know, it's many different diseases. It's domestic violence. It's drug and alcohol abuse. It's accidental shootings. Suicide, it's crime related. You know, these are all kind of like individual, you know, societal problems and diseases, and they all have different root causes and different solutions. And that's why research is so essential, because all of these can be prevented. There's different, you can't treat them all the same way. You know, there are different ways to address these from a societal standpoint. Now, the mass murders, you know, there's a mental health component, which, you know, gets played up too much, I think, but there's also, you know, they say, you know, I love a quote from C. Edward Coops that says, you can't talk about the dangers of snake poisoning without talking about snakes. You have to talk about the guns themselves within the context of mass murder. But for these other issues, for these other more societal issues, you know, these are societal fixes. You know, things like improved mental health care, domestic violence intervention, truancy prevention.
Right.
You know, these are the things that are going to address, you know, the larger problem of gunshot violence, which is the vast majority of what we see in clinical practice.
I think what you're hearing, you know, both from Amy and Heather, is that reducing firearm injury and death in our communities is really going to take a multi-pronged approach. You know, part of it, like Amy was talking about, it's going to take education. It's going to take, you know, us getting, you know, federal research dollars to actually be able to study the cause of gun violence. And I'm sure, as you heard today, the omnibus bill was signed, which has some wording in there that perhaps will get rid of the 22-year-old ban known as the Dickey Amendment. But really the problem has been is that we need our elected officials to really appropriate dollars to look at the ideology of gun violence. And that's going to be critical, because when you look at the proportion of research dollars that goes to something like firearm violence compared to comparable diseases like sepsis, it's quite low. And so part of it, again, education, research, and then obviously common sense, you know, legislation like strengthening our universal background checks and so forth.
We need to see this as a public health crisis. You know, I think that's what Joe is saying and what Heather is saying. I mean, this is a public health crisis that we cannot wait another minute.
Right. The children have mobilized. We have teens mobilizing in our country now. And we look at this movement and, you know, it inspires everyone. And, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, certainly in my generation, I never saw it. And we're seeing this in our generation. So I think, you know, this is something that, you know, is very, very impressive.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because the other day at the Harvard Kennedy School, they had a Parkland Forum where they brought some of the students from Parkland, like Emma Gonzalez and David Hogg. And I think one of the things that they pointed out that is critical, and this goes back to our discussion, is that we have to look at the people that are affected by this also on a daily basis. And, you know, when you look and you compare African Americans to white folks, you see a disproportionate burden when it comes to Black people. They're four times more likely to be killed by firearms. Mm-hmm. And part of that results from the fact that they're 14 more times more likely to be killed by firearms if it's related to homicide. So there is a disparity that exists that has to be addressed, that we can't forget. And I'm glad that, you know, tomorrow at the March for Our Lives movement, there are going to be individuals that are going to be representing those communities. As Amy pointed out, we see this on a daily basis in our cities, and this is something that the American public has to recognize.
Right. I think the vivid images, have to be shown to the public of what these weapons can do. People just don't have those graphic images. And I think if they could see this, this would certainly be some way to help to reduce, gun violence.
Number one thing that we can do, I surely don't want to be disrespectful to anyone, but I can tell you that the citizens of America have not seen what these bullets can do to our kids and our citizens, and people need to see it.
Right.
This, for a doctor, it's not an abstract issue. People look at this as a policy issue on paper, but for us, it's, when you see the damage that's done, it's crushing. And I agree that it's very heartening to see doctors stepping up and saying, this is a public health emergency, that the solutions right. are in science, they lie in public policy, and the CDC is critical. And I was very happy to see that they put some language in the new omnibus bill to say that research is okay, but we still have to get rid of the chilling effect. Fact is that we need funding, and the CDC needs a clear mandate that the expectation is that they're going to address this as the public health emergency that it is and propose solutions, that can be made into policy.
Right, and I think with legislative changes, that certainly is a start, but it's also education, starting in the home, and obviously making that maybe part of this in a comprehensive fashion. Which actually brings me to point, Jill, I wanted to ask you about, certainly very personal experience. You were a victim of gun violence at the age of 17, and I wanted to really discuss how that motivated you to do what you do now.
It's definitely been a big part of who I am and what I do. And, I don't know how you were at 17, but I think most 17-year-olds can't really see past Friday night, as I think Brad Paisley says in one of his songs. And the point is that at that age, you don't really know what you want to do with the rest of your life. You don't appreciate the fact that you're mortal. You don't appreciate the fact, that you have people in your lives that are looking out for you and trying to guide you. And so when I was nearly killed after a 38 caliber bullet ripped through my throat and ended up in my shoulder, and I was given a second chance, it really opened up my eyes. And frankly, what it did was inspire me. It inspired me to go into medicine. It inspired me to become a trauma surgeon. And I think most recently, and this is part of the reason I spent time at the Kennedy School, was it really got me thinking, how do we work at the nexus of medicine, public health, and public policy to make our community safer all across this country? And I'm, grateful for the second chance I've been given. And I just, only hope that we can translate that horrible experience into something positive.
Yeah, your story is quite inspirational. I got the chills when I read that about you and saw your convocation into the American College of Surgeons. Certainly made me think, because I had done some surgical training. It rang true, and it brought back so many memories of me seeing young kids, teens, right on the front lines, getting injured. And so, again, thank you again for your dedication, and it's quite inspirational. Dr. Goldberg and Dr. Shaw, I wanted to follow up, and actually as well as Dr. Segrin, the long-term prognosis after these gunshot wounds, is something often we don't talk about. Chronic pain, wound healing, PTSD, the psychiatric fallout. That's something that, in my mind, is something that needs to be brought up. And maybe get your opinion on all these issues. Dr. Goldberg?
Yeah, it can be devastating. As Joe said, most of the folks being shot in our cities are young African-American males who at 17 and 18, should be having and looking towards a bright future. Instead they find themselves with colostomies or being, paraplegic or quadriplegic, long bone fractures, whatever injuries that you can think of. And even when the physical wounds are healed, they may not be totally healed completely. And then they have all of the emotional and mental wounds that come with that. And right. I am pretty sure actually that we don't always have the supports to give them, in the long term.
Right. And I think that's a good point. We don't have a system in place that deals with the chronicity of care after this horrific injury. And also the economic toll. I mean, this could put people, you know, forever in an economic disadvantage through their entire lives, beyond just the physical and the psychological aspects.
It will affect them and affects their families forever.
Which also, and Heather, I wanted to get your take on this. I'm sure you've dealt with the fallout of these injuries for procedures, for example, that you've seen after the gunshots. You might be consulted about, you know, maybe some interventional procedure. Any thoughts or what's your experience with this?
Well, I am a diagnostic radiologist, so this may be a better question for the surgeons. But I mean, we do see that, you know, with the AR-15s, that the patients have a much rockier hospital course. And the, you know, the care and the complication rate is significantly higher. And that's in the ones that we see. You know, as Goldberg pointed out, these are rare injuries. These are rare because most of these patients die in the field. I think the ones that make it to us clinically are ones that, you know, they have extremity wounds or they were shot, you know, kind of in the periphery of the body. These are lethal injuries.
Any other further issues to bring up amongst the panel, Dr. Sacrin?
Well, I would just say that, you know, I think we're at a point in time where we really have to look seriously at ways to approach this from, again, a multi-pronged kind of approach where we're incorporating education, research, common sense legislation. And I think that, you know, we have to remember that all of us as healthcare providers are unique to form and shape our public narrative into action. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we underestimate how important that is and how powerful that is. It doesn't have to be as dramatic as, you know, being shot in the throat. Each one of our panelists are experts in their own right and have so much tremendous experience. So I encourage, you know, folks to really go out there and to advocate and to have a voice and to stand up just like we're seeing the young people in this country do, because I think it's powerful and I think we're at a tipping point.
Absolutely. And Dr. Goldberg, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think we can't stop the conversation. We can't stop our action. You know, we just have to continue on and make sure that, you know, we, as Joe said and as Heather said, that we really do and make some implementable change.
Absolutely. I want to thank this panel. Incredible. Dr. Scher, Dr. Goldberg, Dr. Sacrin, thank you again for your time. It's such an important issue, and I'll speak to you soon.